This is the kickoff Friday night, May the 12th, 1972. The speaker here, his name is Dr. Paul F. This is the kickoff speaker, starting off with a wonderful show and a wonderful conference all the way through, and as I may say, for my own self, the tapes are good too. Fred Miller, Hubbard, Ohio, member of St. Ross, the tape exchange, tape A.A. only.
Please. Thank you very much. I'm George Maloney. I'm chairman of the Punderson Park AA Conference Group. And on behalf of the committee, I should like to welcome each and every one of you here tonight. We feel that we have a program that you'll enjoy. We hope sincerely that you'll find something here this weekend that you can take home with you that'll help you live the day, a day at a time, the life of AA. Before I turn this meeting over to the chairman, there are a couple things I would like to do. Number one, I would like to introduce a man to you tonight who is mainly responsible for my being here, who came into my home 8.5 years ago and carried the message of AA to me. He was a man who, when I needed help, gave me a helping hand. When I was flying too high, he put me back down in my place where I belonged. I climbed on his coattails. He's been trying to shake me off ever since and hasn't been successful. Frank, it's Frank's birthday today. I can't tell you how old he is. I don't dare to, but I'd like to introduce to you my sponsor, General Frank. Stand up, Frank. And secondly, I'd like to introduce one other person to you tonight. Someone who put up with me for 18.5 years. Of all the things that a man can do to a family, to a wife, to a place in the community, I did. She finally had all she could stand her at and left. But the time came when Frank came to my house and he showed me the way that you people have helped so much with. She's helped me so very, very much in the last 8.5 years, believe me. She's given me all the encouragement in the world that a man could have. When I've been down, she's picked me up. But I think most importantly, she's given me back the responsibilities of a husband and a father, the things that I threw away with 18 years of drinking. I'd like to introduce you to you, my wife, Shirley Maloney. Shirley, now, there's one other thing that is very important. As you know, we're here as guests of the state park. Sunday being Mother's Day, it's an important day as far as the park is concerned, as far as the restaurant is concerned. The meeting Sunday morning will be held at the chalet. After the driveway, the last driveway on the right-hand side as you leave the park, we will have a man there directing traffic. There are approximately 120 parking spaces and more available, but these are marked. There's no reason in the world why you can't find a place to park. So if you would give us the cooperation by checking out at the correct time, if you wish, you can come over there. There will be coffee and there will be donuts, and the meeting will start promptly at 11 o'clock. That is Sunday morning. As you well know, parts of the park are checkout times are at 10. We'd like to make it all at 10 because there is another large group following us immediately into the park. It would be a shame if we had the parking lot filled with cars and made it unavailable to somebody who wanted the dinner and then discovered that there wasn't anybody in their dining room up there. If you would give us the cooperation, I'd appreciate it immensely. Now, you know this is typical of me. I don't know where in the devil I'm going from here. I think I've said everything that was necessary to say, except once again, I should like very, very much to welcome you on behalf of the entire committee. If there's anything that we can do to make your stay more enjoyable, please contact us. We'll do everything that we possibly can. At this time, I'd like to introduce to you Bob, who is the chairman for this evening's program. And from this point on, the chairman will take care of the entire program. Bob?
I would like to add my welcome to George's and welcome you all to this conference tonight. If my voice sounds a little tremulous, because I'm nervous. At this point, I'd like to introduce Reverend Armstrong, who will open the meeting with a prayer. Reverend Armstrong is from the Burton United Church of Christ. Reverend, please.
Let us pray. Almighty God, our strength and our Redeemer, we have much to be thankful for life and health, for families and friends. But we thank you most of all for the strength to use your gifts in good and useful living. We are grateful, too, for your constant faithfulness. For whatever our faults or shortcomings, you have never abandoned or failed us. We have come to trust in your goodness. And so we pray confidently for your presence here this evening. Inspire us, strengthen us, uphold us by your power, that we may leave this place strengthened for your service and bound closer to yourself. Hear this, our common prayer. Amen.
You gotta be kidding. Last time I saw life like that was in a police station. I have here a clipping that I cut out of the paper. It datelined Edinburgh, Texas, and it said, one Pablo Jimenez faced a week in jail and a $50 fine for the unprecedented crime of driving a cotton picker while drunk. He told the judge that he had driven the picker for 4 hours and the trip ended up in a ditch, sustaining $4,000 damage to the picker. The only reason I brought this with me was it's the only for sure proof that I have that there is such a thing as a cotton picking drunken driver. I don't put that down for hurt somebody. There's a song that starts out, it took a miracle to put the stars in place. It took a miracle to hang the world in space. But when he saved my soul, cleansed and made me whole, it took a miracle of love and grace. You are looking at a miracle. And this room is full of miracles. However, the thing that I have to constantly remember is that I have been the receiver of a miracle and not the creator of one. As he said, my name's Dr. Paul F. I'm a problem drinker. Had I been born earlier, they would have called me the village drunkard. But the word drunkard, you see, is so sociologically unacceptable that they coined a word for us and called us alcoholics. And the word alcoholic is just as sociologically unacceptable, so they coined another phrase for us, and now they call us problem drinkers. In a couple of years, if a movement afoot takes place, I'm sure we will all become known as victims of Jelinek's disease. And that isn't going to tell anybody anything. But like my good friend from North Carolina said, whenever he sees an animal coming towards him and it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and it waddles like a duck, it's a cotton-picking duck. A man walked up to his minister one day after the Sunday morning service and he said, "Preacher," he said, "I've got a problem." He says, "I come to church on Sunday morning and I get uplifted by the music. I feel good after hearing the sermon. The words from the big book make me feel better. And I can go out of church on Sunday morning feeling like I could lick the world." And then comes Monday. And the minister says, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. He says, I have people that stand up in front of me and vow before God to honor and obey in sickness and in health until death do them part. And then comes Monday. We alcoholics, unfortunately, you see, are very accident prone. Every time we get up in the morning, we run smack dab into living. And then comes Monday. If I can just help you with Monday, my trip will have been worthwhile. I went to my first AA meeting. Let me take that back. I got dragged to my first AA meeting down a flight of stairs into a basement of a bank building. I was three quarters drunk. I was a full-blown agnostic. I was $54,000 in debt and didn't know it. I had lost the right to manage money, to raise my kids as I see fit, to run my home as I see fit. And I had about as much awareness of what my problem was as the poor inebriate who fell off of the roof of the Chrysler building and fell down through all the awnings and he landed in the gutter at the doorman's feet. And a large crowd gathered around him and two kindly old ladies helped him up out of the gutter and brushed him off, and they said, what happened? And he looked around at the crowd and said, I don't know, I just got here. As I stand here this evening, I am no longer a drinking alcoholic. I am no longer an agnostic. I am no longer $54,000 in debt. I regained the rights that I lost. And I do understand what my problem is. So obviously, someplace between that first meeting and tonight, a lot of things have happened to me. And I thought if I could just enumerate for you what it took to get me from my first meeting to here, just maybe, one person in this room would be helped and makes the trip worthwhile. As I look back over it, certain things had to happen to me, the first of which I had to have developed within myself, or at least from outside or inside, what George Wiedemann would call a sincere and monumental desire to get well. Anything short of this is probably doomed to failure. And it hurts my soul to watch alcoholism promoted 5, 10, 15 years beyond where it ought to go merely because the desire to get well isn't created for them, since they're incapable of creating their own. The alcoholic, you see, if you'll visualize for me, a garage sitting out on an empty lot, and this garage hasn't been used for a long time. The weeds have overgrown the driveway. The paint is peeling off of the board from the weather, and it's a mess. And the neighbors don't like this eyesore, and they tell the landlord to tear this thing down because it's depreciating their property. Well, the landlord, he comes out with a crowbar and a hammer, and one board at a time, he knocks this garage down till it's level with the cement. However, being Scotch, he doesn't like to waste the lumber, so when he gets all through, he nails it all back together again. And he looks at what he's got, and lo and behold, he's built the biggest outhouse in the neighborhood. And the neighbors don't like that either. So one board at a time, with the same hammer, the same crowbar, the same tools, he tears it all back down again. And then he nails it all back up, and lo and behold, this time he's built himself a small chapel. Now, it is utterly incapable of this garage to convert itself into a chapel by itself. Just as it is unlikely that the alcoholic is capable of converting itself into something worthwhile. Modern day parlance, we would call it recycling, you see. And in order to recycle anything, be it a can or a bottle or an alcoholic, you have to apply some sort of outside force to remold what you already have without wasting what you've got. And this is essentially what happens to us. So we're going to get recycled, maybe. However, we also, in this matter of desire, we make a mistake sometime when we settle for good enough. You know, good is the enemy of best. When you settle for good enough, when you could have had the best there is with just a little more effort. Well, so much for desire. That isn't going to keep me dry. It isn't going to even get me sober. I needed something else called acceptance. Now, I went to this meeting, and some fellow was standing up there talking. Well, man, I like to die at that meeting. I hadn't smoked for 5 years, and they dragged me in the basement of this bank building, three-quarters drunk, and the smoke you could cut with a knife, and I almost died down there. And someplace out of all this smoke, some man says, you're an alcoholic. And to me, I said, so what? To an Irish drinker, it's like graduating cum laude, you see. Someplace else in this talk, a lot of stuff went on, and someplace else in there, he says, you can never, ever drink again. And I says, you go to hell. Man, I didn't join that group to quit drinking, I'll tell you. Someplace else in this story, he said, if you want to get well, man, I didn't even know I was sick. He says, if you want to get well, there are certain steps you can follow, guaranteed to work, if you'll follow them. So I said to the man that brought me, what's he talking about? And he read the 12-step off a piece of AA literature, and all I could hear was God this and higher power that, make amends for this. And I knew I got hooked up with some kooky religious outfit that I didn't want any part of. Well, the man had jarred me, however. Obviously, I went away from that meeting less than enthralled with this whole bit. But this man had said to me, you've got a disease and you'll never get over it. Imagine that. This peon was telling this doctor I had a disease I didn't even know he was talking about. So I dragged out all my medical books and all the free AA literature they could get my hands on. I wasn't going to buy any. And I read whatever I could read about alcohol and alcoholism, out of which you amass a mountain of facts, most of which to this day aren't connected. But certain things begin to glare out at you. One thing they threw at me was a statistic. I don't like to bother people with statistics. I'll just bother you with two this evening. Yeah, I lost my fingers. The first one they threw at me was, they said in this country there are something like 90 million people that drink alcohol, out of which there are approximately 9 million of them who are alcoholics. And kind, just like everybody else, I have to say, why me? Why does it have to be me that becomes the alcoholic instead of the other 81 million that can still go out there and drink? Well, out of all this reading, you see, certain things begin to glare out at you. Now, a psychiatrist would have me believe that I am an alcoholic either because I was breastfed or bottle-fed, whichever one he wasn't. That I either had anxiety neuroses or suicidal tendencies, that I came from either a low economic group or a high economic group, that I was either an only child or the middle one of 12 or the last one of 23. You know, surprisingly enough, before I started this medical directorship and the other practice I had patients that fit every one of these categories, none of whom were alcoholics as far as I know. I had patients who I know were either breastfed or bottle-fed. There ain't no other way to get here. I had patients who I know came from different economic groups, as my account receivable drawer would show. I had patients who had attempted suicide. I had patients who had succeeded with suicide. I had patients who I know had some kind of kooky anxiety, neuroses, and so on. But the one thing that all my patients had in common was that they were pregnant. And you know, they're not pregnant for any of those reasons. It boiled down into a very simple fact, you see, that an alcoholic is an alcoholic because someplace along the line he drank alcohol. I never yet have met an alcoholic that never drank. Never. I never have met an alcoholic in whom the symptoms of alcoholism continued after he quit drinking. Never. I have never met an alcoholic, including myself, that ever drank alcohol by force. We drink alcohol by choice. And since we drink the alcohol by choice, then we are responsible for everything that happens as a result of our drinking it and nobody else. We can't lay it on another living soul because they didn't have the choice. Now, the problem at the beginning with me was that I read too much, you see, just like everybody else. I was so interested in when did it start and why and how much did it take and why me that I didn't do anything. I became a victim of what I like to call analysis paralysis. So busy analyzing that I didn't do anything. And you find as you start taking an inventory here and there that you're guilty of the same process in a lot of other fields. Just so busy analyzing that nothing gets done. Well, the worst thing that somebody could do, you see, for me, would be to substitute pills for booze. I found that out in a hurry. Booze being a drug, you see, and it's utterly ridiculous to substitute one drug for another drug. That's stupid. That's like putting a penny in a fuse box. The disaster is on its way. Well, I had to accept the fact that if I am going to call myself an alcoholic, then for the rest of my life, I can never, ever drink again, safely. That no matter how long I stay dry, I can never, ever start drinking again. These things I had to learn to accept. So much for acceptance. That isn't going to get the job done for me either. Along with acceptance, I had to have something called hope. They dragged me down this flight of stairs into this bank building and said, "This will work." How about that? Man and myself, just like every other alcoholic, we had tried to kick this thing many times by ourselves and nothing worked. And yet these people had the audacity to drag me down a flight of stairs, damn near killed me with the smoke and said, "This will work." As far as I knew when I walked down this stairs, you see, I wasn't aware of any other doctor that was stupid enough to be hung on booze. I knew one who said he was, but I never saw him drunk, you see. I knew doctors who were hooked on pills, but as far as I knew, I didn't know any doctor that was hooked on booze. I thought I was a Lone Ranger. And Lone Rangerism in this game will kill you. Like zebras being amongst a bunch of horses. This is what we think we are. And I was firmly convinced as I walked down that stairs that if I stopped drinking, I'd die. And yet I walked into this meeting, and here's this room full of people who said, "We used to be as bad as you are, only we don't drink anymore." So either they were bold-faced lying to me, or else they had found something that I hadn't tried yet, which worked. Now, I never saw an alcoholic yet that wasn't a pig. We're a pig about everything, you know. We'll go early and stay late. We'll take two drinks at a time. Whatever we do, it's in pig fashion. In fact, even after we sober up, one of the traits we still maintain, and I swear most alcoholics do, and that is that anything worth doing at all is worth doing to excess. I still do it. Anyway, these people said, "You don't have to drink anymore if you don't want to." How about that? They said, "You don't have to drink if you don't want to." Like I had some sort of a choice. Then a series of coincidences begin to happen to me. This is with a parenthesis around. This is what we call them, you know. Before we come to this program, we call these things coincidences that happen to us. Like, it's a coincidence when you stack your automobile against the post, you just stick your head through the windshield instead of the solid metal roof. You only miss the metal roof by an inch, and you look and say, "By George, wasn't that a coincidence?" It's a coincidence when you sail out of the fourth floor of a Kansas City hotel, you get your foot caught in a drapery cord, you just dangle there four flights above the street. Wasn't that a coincidence? It's a coincidence that we get to this program alive, we think. However, by coincidence, somebody had a lot of nerve. They took this agnostic drunk and dragged him to a Christmas Eve service. Now, at 11:30, obviously on some given signal, every light in that church went out. It got pitch black in that church, except for one candle that was sitting up on the altar. And you know, no matter how pitch black it got in that church, that candle wouldn't go out. It tried, but it wouldn't go out. And then the minister took a candle and lit it from that one, and then he lit one that each of eight ushers had, and they went down the aisle, and they were lighting candles of the people in the pews, and at midnight, that church looked like Monument Circle at I&M. What it was showing me was that it doesn't make any difference how black my past is or anybody else's when they come to this program. Their past isn't bad enough that the program won't work if they want it to. You can't have a past that's black enough to make this program inoperable. It'll work. And then by coincidence, at the next meeting I went to, the man got up and said, when he came to this program, he had trouble with God stuff, as he chose to call it. And his sponsor told him, if the word God bothers you, spell it with two O's and be it. Now, there isn't anybody in this room that can't be G-O-O-D if he wants to be. And you can be good, good, good to the point where you're almost godly. What he was showing me was, however, that I could take and substitute a word here and there in the 12 steps so that I could hang on to a step long enough to get to the next one. The step would fit me. Now, I've been criticized by people in AA before for telling people you can substitute words in the 12 steps. But I know that if you make this program, the 12 steps will be right back the way they were originally written anyway. So I don't mind telling people to substitute if it helps them hang on. Of course, I'm being criticized, mind you, by saying people that substitute the word slip for failure and don't think a thing about it. Anyhow, another coincidence, I picked up a book, and in this book I was reading, you know, I didn't even wear glasses when I came to this program. I found out AA can be detrimental to your eyesight. You read so much, you need glasses eventually. But anyway, in this book, there was a story about a little farmer, and that poor soul had more trouble than Job did, I swear he did. No matter what he did, it turned out wrong. His pigs got cholera, his corn washed out, his barn burned down, you name it, and it happened to this poor man. And somebody, one day he was standing alongside the road leaning on the fence, and a man asked him, how in the world, in the face of all this adversity, did he have guts enough to start over every day? And he said, you know, I'm a student of the Bible. He said, I've read it many times. And in this book it says 150 times, it came to pass. No place in that book did it say it came to stay. So I don't care where you find yourself at the moment, you don't have to stay there very long. I remember as a kid taking a wagon someplace to get free groceries because we were in the midst of something called a depression, but it disappeared. I remember a sinkhole over in New Guinea during World War II, but a whole world war disappeared. And a Korean War disappeared, and very shortly a Vietnamese War is going to disappear. I remember a lot of good people that have been alive in my lifetime, and they're gone also, even good passes. No matter where you are, you don't have to put up with it any longer than you want to. Now, so much for hope. I also need something called faith. Now, you mentioned the word faith to an agnostic like I was, and boy, all you're going to see are two shoes going through the farthest door. Because for some reason, when you mention the word faith, they always put a religious meaning to it, and it isn't necessary. So we'll substitute a word, and we'll call it confidence. means exactly the same thing, only it doesn't scare anybody. First of all, I have to develop some sort of confidence in myself. Like the man said, I don't have any confidence in myself. And I said, well, where were you at 5 o'clock? And he said, I was at home. What did you do then? I got in the car and came to the meeting. When you left your home, where did you intend to arrive? And he said, at the meeting. And I said, you made it, didn't you? Little things, little man. Confidence in little things will grow into confidence in bigger things. We always like to be bigger than we think we are. And I found out that we're no bigger than the small end of nothing, sharpened to a fine point. Anyhow, someplace along the line, we're not in the A very long, and they haul off and throw something at us called an inventory. My word. Inventory. Can you imagine such a thing? You use a whole tank car load of red ink and 2 drops of black ink. And it says, go from there. But that's true. Those 2 drops of black ink are the 2 most important drops of ink you'll ever see in your lifetime. Because all it takes is 2 so that you put another one on top of it and start a foundation. And it doesn't make any difference how much black ink you've used. So when you come to this program, don't downgrade yourself too far. Because no matter how bad you are, no matter how bad the alcoholic is, no matter how good you think you are, no human being that is still alive is a zero. They still have something going for them. Like the thing I read in the paper, it said, I may not be somebody with a capital S, but I am me. And I cannot do everything, but some things I can do. And the things I can do, I ought to do. And the things I ought to do, by the grace of God, I will do. So if you need a place to start back on this program, we start with the things that we ought to do. And one of the first things that we ought to do, let's put it another way, one of the first things we'll have to do is develop within ourselves something called 100% honesty. I have yet to see a chronic alcoholic practice his profession without lying. I have yet to see anybody stay sober without staying honest. It reminds me of the man that was sitting at a bar at a table and he just drank too much. And gradually, as he drank too much, he just slithered off the chair and underneath the table. And he was out underneath the table, and his buddy decided to play a trick on him. So he taped a piece of Limburger cheese to his upper lip. Even drunk, it didn't take him long to come out from under that table. His face was all flushed, his eyes were bugged out, sweat was pouring down his face, and he looked around the room and dashed out in the street and came back in and went out the back door and came back in. And he looked all over the bar room and said, my God, the whole world stinks. But you know it wasn't the whole world at all. It was right there. And unless you can get the alcoholic to put it right there, he isn't going to make this program. And once he forgets that that's where it's going to stay, he's going to lose this program. And that's predictable. Sometimes when you're feeling important, and sometimes when your ego's in bloom, sometimes when you take it for granted that you're the best qualified in the room, sometimes when you think that you're going would leave an unfillable hole, just follow this little example and see what it does for your soul. Take a bucket and fill it with water and stick your arm in it clear up to the wrist. Pull it out, and the hole that's remaining is a measure of how you'll be missed. There's no such thing, you see, as the indispensable individual. Did you ever stop? I was on a program one time, and they had Professor Backwards on there as a part of the entertainment. You know, he said, did you ever stop to think that the word boss spelled backwards is double S-O-B? Nobody's indispensable, you see. My friend from Mississippi tells the story about the man that comes home one day and he said to his little boy, he says to the boy, "Have you been a good little boy today?" He said, "No." He said, "Have you been a bad little boy?" And the boy said, "No." Well, he says, "What have you been?" He says, "Comfortable." And that's about where we intend to be, and that's about where we're going to be, because nobody in this room, including myself or anybody that I know, is perfect. Everybody makes mistakes. The problem is to make less mistakes each day and be comfortable doing it, you see. But by and large, the alcoholic, unfortunately, he figures that if he makes one mistake, you see, he's flunked the program. And this one mistake is enough to throw him back in the jug. He doesn't realize that no matter how long he works, no matter how hard he works, no matter how high he reaches, he'll never be perfect. And neither will anybody else, so that don't make him any different. And this is true. Which gets me back to the second statistic. These people said that there were 9 million alcoholics. Out of this 9 million alcoholics, we have approximately 600,000 that are staying sober in AA. And maybe we have 150,000 people staying sober some other way, which means that roughly 8.25 million people are going to die from their alcoholism because they refuse to do anything about it. And yet I've been chosen to survive. And so now I have to ask myself again, why me? Why have I been chosen to survive and not die in the gutter? Because if you think you got here through your own choice, you're sadly mistaken. If you look back over your life since the time you became an alcoholic till now, you'll find out that it wasn't a coincidence that you're here alive today. And if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we have to answer this question, why me? Now, nobody says that you can do this by yourself any more than you can recycle a bottle by itself, remember? We're entitled to get all the help it takes to do whatever it takes to get the job done. We come to this program and we have devastated this physical being of ours. We're entitled to get any doctor it takes to put this body back in as good a shape that it can be put back into. We come to this program with our heads so snarled up even a cat couldn't do it to a ball of yarn. And we're entitled to get it unscrambled. Psychiatrist, psychologist, sociologist, whatever it takes, we're entitled to. We come to this program with what I like to call gangrene of the soul. We become some of the most amoral individuals I know. We're entitled to do something about that. Ministers, priests, rabbis, whatever it takes, we're entitled to it. We're also entitled to everything that AA has to offer. AA, you see, is something like the Good Samaritan. In this Good Samaritan, they beat this poor soul to death and left him laying along the roadside for dead. And the robbers that did this, I do it on the principle of what's yours is mine and I'm going to take it. And then these other two hotshots came along and saw this guy laying there, and they didn't think he was beneath them, so they just kept on walking, you see, on the principle of what's mine is mine, and I'm going to keep it. But the Good Samaritan came along and bandaged up the fellow's wounds and put him on a horse and took him to a hotel and said, "Keep him overnight, and I'll be back. If that ain't enough money, we'll get some more." On the principle of what's mine is yours, and you're welcome to it. However, if you don't ask, we can't give. You see, it says, "Ask and you shall receive." We can't read your mind, so all we have to do is ask for it. And we're entitled to everything AA has to offer. Then, by coincidence, I picked up another book, and in this book, it happened to be Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking. In this book, he cited example after example of people who had problems, and through what he called prayer power, their problems were solved. And he said there's a power loose in this universe, and all you have to do to latch onto it is to pray. Well, the problem is that you don't see it. They tell me that if you plug a light in the socket and turn the switch, the light goes on, and lo and behold, it does. But I've never been able to find out why, because I've taken the socket apart and I don't see anything, except you get jolted across the room. They tell me, and there's nobody in this room that can tell me what gravity is. You can tell me what it does, but you can't tell me what it is. But if you don't think it exists, you go out of that Kansas City hotel and try to go up. But you can't see it, you see. In another little book it said, do you know that through the medium of television, that on a particular evening at a given time, Dean Martin can be in every living room in the United States simultaneously? And I got to thinking, by George, if Dino can do that, somebody else ought to be able to do that. And then I latched on to another little book called Psycho-Cybernetics. Now, if you just tear the cover off so that the title doesn't bother you, and put it with your Vincent Peale Power of Positive Thinking, is the best two-volume library you can have. Vincent Peale's book tells you that it works. Psycho-Cybernetics tells you why it works. But he said, all you have to do to latch on to this power is to pray. So I said, okay, if you haven't tried it, don't knock it, so we'll try it. And I did. I said, you do this for me, I'll do that for you. That's the way everybody prays, isn't it? You know, you do this for me and I'll do that for you. Boy, you don't make deals, I found that out. I found out that it's very simple. You don't have to get very fancy about this thing. I said, this ain't working, so we'll try something else. So I try to be as simple as I possibly could be. I said, Lord, thanks. Amen. I'd even enumerate what for. I couldn't even think of what for. Just Lord, thanks. Amen. Little things, little man, remember? Gratitude is the basis of the whole bit. When you're thankful for little things, you get bigger things. Man sitting next to me says, I don't have anything to be thankful for. And I looked at him, and man, he was a mess. He looked like he got hit by a bus. And I looked at him, I said, well, you can start by being thankful that wrinkles aren't painful. Yeah. Or that when you comb your hair in the morning, the hair you find on your comb is not like just having gone to the dentist. Little things, little man, when you're thankful for little things, you get bigger things. And it's the most amazing thing that you get things you don't even ask for, so long as you're thankful for what you have. Now, don't ask me why, because I'm not going to get in this analysis paralysis routine again. I'm just going to do it, and so be it. By coincidence, about the same time, there was a rap on my front door, and I was sitting in my living room, and there was a man there I never saw before in my life. He says, I just happened to be in your neighborhood. Just happened to be in my neighborhood. His church is 9 miles from my house. And he just happened to be in my neighborhood and rapped on this alcoholic door, a house in which nobody is talking to anybody. There's battle flags flying in every room. The most unchristian house on the block, and he wants to know, do I want to join his church? And I said, I don't think so. Hey, he does something for you even if you don't want it to. Anyway, I said, I'd like to talk to you about it. He says, okay, you come down and we'll talk to you about it. And so the next Tuesday, I surprised two people. I went to surprise myself because I went, and I surprised him because I arrived there. When I walked in, by coincidence, he was different. I had talked to men of the cloth before about my agnosticism, but invariably I would say something that they'd take as a blasphemous statement against what they believed, and that was the end of that. But I walked in there, and this man's different. I hadn't said anything yet. He says, I don't care what you think. But if you don't tell me what you think, I can't help you at all. So, with no holds barred, he and I took off on religion. 14 meetings I met with that man, just like AA meetings. And we took care of religion all the way from alligators to hereafter. Out of which I could develop a creed for myself that I can believe in. I know that to this day it's not what that man believes, but it doesn't make any difference. It may not be what anybody in this room believes, and that doesn't make any difference. So long as I believe in something bigger than myself. The next thing I found out that I had to do, I had to attend meetings. And you, like myself, on the outside will find that people come up and say, why do you have to go to all those cotton-picking meetings? You ought to be up to here with meetings. Which may be true. The simple answer for that is that I have never found anybody sobering up in a saloon. I have never seen anybody get drunk at an AA meeting. Never. That's a simple answer. Probably Billy Graham had the best answer I know. He was leaving Australia after having put on one of his crusades, and the man that had brought him over there was just simply astounded at the thousands of people that had poured out of the stands at the end of this thing. And he says to Billy, he says, you're going to go back to the United States. He says, do you think this will have a lasting effect on all these people? And Billy says, how long does one bath last you? So if somebody wants to know why you're going to the AA meeting, tell them you're going to take a bath. Then ask them, how often do they take a bath? That's a fair question. They ask you first. You see, we pick up a lot of dirt between meetings. I told you, we run smack dab into living every time we turn around, and we pick up dirt, and that's what meetings are. They're spiritual baths, if nothing else. I found out also that I needed something else. I needed something called balance. And I like to look at it like a cross stuck in a... In order for a cross, you see, to stand up, it has to stand in some kind of firm foundation. And so we'll call that faith. And the more faith we have, the firmer this cross is going to stand up. And a cross, you see, has three arms. And if you let one of these arms get too long, just by pure physics, it's going to fall over. And we'll label them, and we'll call them AA and home and business. Now, if you let one of them get too long, it's going to topple over. I got acutely aware of this problem one day. I'd been on this program for a while, and I thought I was doing pretty good. I evidently hadn't decobwebbed yet. I drove in my front yard, and my son ran up to the car and says, where have you been? As if it was any of his cotton-picking business where I had been. But you see, he didn't realize that once I left the house, I was going to come home sober. He had absolutely no faith in the world that I'd come home sober. I've been going to AA, but I didn't do any homework, you see. And I figured, by George, I better do some repair work at home. And then I better start doing some repair work where I work. And you know, things get a lot easier when you don't have too many broken down fences. And the less fences you have busted down, the better. What we're after is what most manufacturers are yelling about these days. Quality control. Not quantity control. Quality control. And the clock of life is wound but once, and no man has the power to tell just when the clock will stop at late or early hour. To lose one's wealth is sad indeed, and to lose one's health is more, but to lose one's soul is such a loss that no man can restore. The present only is your own, and you live, love, toil with a will, and you place no faith in tomorrow, for the clock may then be still. How much time do you have left to do what you ought to do? This is a question I had to ask myself one night as I staggered out of the bank, you see. How much time do I have left? If I'm going to make this program, I'd better, by George, get at it. Which leads me to the thing called action, which is what this program is all about.
You know, even if you're on the right track, you're going to get run over if you just sit there. There's no such thing as an escalator to sobriety. You're going to plow it one step at a time. I never yet have seen a contest won by people sitting on a bench. You win it out in the middle, knocking heads together. It's an action program, you see. Now, the Spanish proverb says, you can have anything you want, says God. Anything at all. Just take it. Take it and pay for it. And that's true. You can have anything you want. You can become anybody you want to become if you're willing to pay the price for it. It cost you an unholy price to drink like we did. It also costs a price to stay sober, but you can have it if you're willing to pay for it. But when you get what you want and your struggle for wealth and the world makes you king for a day, then go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what the glass has to say. You can cheat all you want through the pathway of years and get tapped on the back as you pass. But your final reward will be heartache and tears if you've cheated the man in the glass. Quality control is what you're... You can have anything you want. All you have to do is pay for it. Believe that or not, it's true. Now, we make mistakes. And when we make a mistake, we think the program's failed and we dive into a jug. Never realizing that this mistake we make, you see, is experience that we do have upon which to make our next judgment. Now, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So when we make a mistake, it's not enough to dive back in the jug, you see. You just label it experience and go on from there. Like the man said, it's no disgrace to fall in the mud. The disgrace is to lay there and wallow in it. Now, step 12 in our 12 steps says, practice these principles in all our affairs. That's the last phrase. Evidently, people get tired of reading by the time they get that far. But it says all our affairs, not just alcohol. You know, one of the most astounding things that they told me was, they pointed their finger at me and they said, you know, it's utterly impossible for you to drink the second drink without drinking the first one. What an astounding statement. But it is 100% true. It's utterly impossible to drink the second drink without drinking the first one. All our affairs, it says, you can't tell the second lie till you tell the first one. You can't cut the second corner till you cut the first one. You can't cheat your first, second customer till you cheat the first one. You can't do anything the second time until you do it the first time. Like Father Powell says, all you do is eliminate firsts. No firsts, no seconds. That's not complicated. Well, all you have to do is resist beginnings, he says. All right, so if I don't lie anymore, that'll help my morality a little bit. If I don't cheat, that'll help. If I don't drink, it's going to help my physical being. It'll help my way of thinking. It's amazing how eliminating one little thing at a time will help, you see. And then I really got jolted because they told me that I couldn't keep it if I didn't give it away. Boy, that sentence will drive you right up the wall. How are you going to keep anything if you give it away? But it's like a fellow says, if you're standing in a puddle of water with some rubber boots on and you grab a high tension line, nothing happens. Because there's no way for the electricity to get out, the electricity can't get in. But if you get out of those boots and you let the thing go into the ground, if there's a way out, there's a way in. And the more you let out, the more you get in. And this is a physical fact. Like the little song you hear nowadays that says that a bell is not a bell till it's rung, and a song's not a song till it's sung. And love isn't put in your heart to stay. Love isn't love till you give it away. And that's true. Till you do something with it. Most people, including myself, I found that I was living this way. If I did something good, I would shout it from the rooftops. I'd say, give me my reward, you know, pat me on the back. I want a ribbon, whatever I got coming, you give it to me. And I got it. The proverb says, pay for it and you get it. If I did something that wasn't good, no way would I be shouting it from the rooftops, you know. You kick it under the rug, you hide it in the closet. And you wind up down the road, I've gotten all the rewards I had coming, and I've got a whole closet full of liabilities that I still have to pay for. That's what the proverb says, pay for it. When all I had to do was turn it around. If I do something good, like the car dealer in our area says, you don't tell nobody. You just keep it to yourself. If you do something that isn't good, pay for it. Today, right now. And lo and behold, I wind up down the road and I got a whole bunch of assets coming that I've earned. And I haven't collected them, but my debts have been paid one day at a time. And I don't have to put up tomorrow with a debt that I owe today because I already paid it. You do all the good you can by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, to all the people you can, at all the times you can, for as long as ever you can. Boy, that'll keep you busy. Or you come down to something like this. It says, have you made someone happy? Have you made someone sad? What have you done with the day that you had? God gave it to you to do as you would. Did you do what was wicked or do what was good? Did you hand out a smile or just give them a frown? Did you pick someone up or just push him down? Did you lighten some load or some progress impede? Did you look for a rose or just gather a weed? What have you done with your beautiful day? God gave it to you. Did you throw it away? You have to take time to laugh. It's the music of the soul. You have to take time to think. It's the source of eternal power. You have to take time to play. It's the source of perpetual youth. You have to take time to read. It's the fountain of wisdom. You have to take time to pray. It's the greatest power on earth. You have to take time to love and be loved. It's a God-given privilege. You have to take time to be friendly. It's the road to happiness. You have to take time to give. It's a too short of a day to be selfish. And you have to take time to work. It's the price of success. Boy, that'll keep your day busy, I'll tell you. Let me wrap it up with this. Says, the Lord is my sponsor, I shall not want. He maketh me to go to many meetings. He leadeth me to sit back and relax and listen with an open mind. He restoreth my sanity and health. He leadeth me in the paths of sobriety and fellowship for mine own sake. He teaches me to think and to take it easy and live and let live and do first things first. He maketh me desire to be honest and humble and grateful. He teacheth me to accept the things I cannot change and to change the things I can, and giveth me the wisdom to know the difference. Yea, though I walk through the valley of despair and frustration and guilt and remorse, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. The AA program, the new way of life, the 12 steps, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Rationalization and fear and anxiety and self-pity and resentment. Thou anointest my confused mind and jangled nerves with knowledge and understanding and love and hope. No longer am I alone. Neither am I afraid or sick helpless, or hopeless. Surely sobriety and sanity and serenity shall follow me every day of my life, 24 hours at a time, as I surrender my will to thine and carry the message to another. I will dwell in the house of my higher power forever and ever. Amen. Edgar Guest said, I would rather see a sermon than hear one any day. I would rather that you walked with me than just merely point the way. The lectures that you give may be very fine and true, but I'd rather get my lessons by observing what you do. I might misunderstand all the lofty words you give, but there's no misunderstanding how you act and how you live. And for that, you are responsible. May you all be in heaven a half an hour before the devil knows you're dead. Thank you.